CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com. And call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
Leave. On CBS Radio's The Sky. The Sky.
Welcome back. Our guest today is author Stan Cox, talking about his new book, Any Way You Slice It. I'm Cassandra from CBS Sky Radio, and we're going to go right back to CJ and Stan.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. So now we're going to be talking about healthcare and the exponential growth of healthcare. And at one point, as everything else, we're going to have a limit. In fact, we probably, one would argue, we already do have limits in healthcare. And I wanted to bring two examples that Stan brings up in his book, Any Way You Slice It. And this gives you a sense of the ethical dilemmas that we are going to have been and continue to approach as our healthcare costs escalate. So here's the question for you. You have two candidates for a life-saving treatment. One is a 20-year-old who will live for 50 years after the treatment. The second person is an 85-year-old who will live for another year after the treatment. Who would you save? So ponder that. Here's the second example that gives you a sense of the ethics involved with limiting health care. Let's say that there's a special heart pump that costs about $200,000. There's technology, it's $200,000 per heart pump. It would benefit 200,000 people and cost $40 million. And as a result of that heart pump, it would give the recipient 1 to 2 years more of life. So if we have to put limits on how much we're spending in healthcare, should we spend the $40 million and have that permissible in our healthcare costs? So those are, I don't know, to me those were incredible examples that made me really think about, wow, I understand the dilemma. It's easy to be protesting and throwing tomatoes at Obama and like, wow, you know, I don't like this, but there's some real issues. So welcome, Stan.
Yeah, you're right. In trying to sort out how rationing works and how it should work and with various other resources, it was fairly easy to come to some conclusions. With healthcare, it's such a contentious area, and we're dealing with such deep-seated feelings that it's really hard to see what the solution could be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing that you brought in your first chapter or that first part of that section in your book is you said that if people were given a rational, like, here are the numbers, here's the analysis, they can easily make, like, well, of course, I would opt for the 20-year-old versus the 85-year-old. And no, I wouldn't spend money on that heart pump. But if you have a dying person in front of you, the answers then get thrown up in the air, right? I can't remember what you called that as an effect, but that's...
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And these medical economists and philosophers talk about the so-called rule of rescue, which says that if there is some treatment or procedure that can prolong or save or prolong the life of somebody and provide an actual benefit, then there's an obligation to use it. But it doesn't specify. Yeah, and this is just something that seems to be deep in people's brains. But we aren't able to specify how big a benefit. Is it just a couple of days of life, or is it another year living in the miserable conditions? Where do you draw the line? And there are some of these economists and philosophers who say there is no line. We just have to spend whatever amount it's going to take, even with health care taking up 18% of our entire economy now and scheduled to keep rising. Do we really think, and with technology producing new treatments and procedures every year, many of them of dubious value, but they're there, and once they're in the doctor's arsenal, there's felt to be an obligation to use them. But we, at the same time, we have over-treatment being paid for out of this 18% of our GDP. We have under-treatment at the same time. As we know, people who don't have enough money or insurance, studies show consistently get much lower levels, quantity and quality of health care than people who do, and that seems fundamentally unfair.
I think one of the examples that you had in this particular chapter that I thought was illustrative of the things that you're talking about is that, was it in Cuba where, you know, their health care is actually, the actual results are pretty good, but they don't spend hardly as much money because they said, this is how much we can spend on you, we're done, right? And we're not going to give you the fancy pantsy whatever the newest technology is. We're going to give you what we know works, and that's what all you, we can afford, and we're done, right? Is that yeah, in Cuba? I can't remember where that was.
Right, that's one place where they spend 4% as much as we do per capita, and a lot of that is on preventive medicine. And you know, we wouldn't. I'm not saying we should cut 96% of our healthcare spending, but we do need to think about things reasonably. We do have methods for doing this, and that's in the case of absolute scarcity, where there isn't enough of a drug to go around, or if there's an influenza emergency and there aren't enough respirators, and or in the organ transplant world, they've worked out the system for waiting lists and so forth that are quite elaborate and are very well thought out. So we know how to do these things, but we don't. What we don't know is if we have the capacity to produce these medical products. How do we decide whether they actually should be produced or not?
I thought that was a really interesting point. So maybe we should limit the amount of medical technology that's out there. You know, because part of the reason why it's so hard to keep up with it and that these costs keep on going up is because all these technologies keep on going, getting introduced. And by the way, they're really expensive because their companies are trying to defer their R&D costs. So it's a crazy kind of cycle. And so you were talking about the, cases of like the flu virus, right? Where a couple years ago, there was only a certain number of batches. They underproduced the amount of vaccines that they got. And in previous cases, they've had limits on that. And in that particular case, they did have some rationale, and people were okay with that, which was fascinating to me. I mean, we were on the list, and we didn't get our flu vaccination until later. But I thought, you know what, those people who are pregnant or kids who are younger, people have, you know, asthma, they should get it before me. So I think people are okay with some of it, right?
Right, and people are sensible. Where we always see what's called rationing by queuing or waiting in line is in the emergency room, and people accept the idea of triage very, very easily, that people who need care the most urgently should be seen first. And if you're there with a rash or something, you can wait until more urgent things are taken care of. One example here that they've just been talking about recently is the lack of development of new antibiotics at the same time that we have these antibiotic resistant bacteria out there, but it's not very profitable for companies, and so the drug companies are making lifestyle drugs or other drugs that have to be taken every day and are expensive, and have basically stopped a lot of the research on new antibiotics, which could be the most critical drugs of all here one of these days. And so you do end up with cases of rationing.
Yeah. But the one that I didn't like, which you, so, you know, there's queuing, there's providing some set of, like, criteria on who gets what first as a limited resource. And like you said, whether it's the emergency room or the flu influenza, we're able to deal with that. I think people would have problems with the technology rationing. People, by meaning people, I mean healthcare companies. but I think the one I didn't like was lottery. Where it's we can't decide what we want to do, and everyone gets so pissed off if we put criteria, we're just going to do a lottery, and whoever we draw, number 1, 5, and 10, you will get saved, the rest of you, sorry. That's the only one I didn't like.
Well, there is a certain appeal in that, and it was first used in very early antibiotic trials where they only had a very limited quantity of antibiotic available, and to do a trial, you had to have people who were treated and those that weren't, and they determined that by lottery. And there have been people who say we shouldn't play God and decide who gets treatment when there are absolute shortages like that, and a lottery is the fairest way. But then the response—it's
like God, random and unpredictable.
Right. But people. Respond, well, a lottery could very easily give you the result that the 85-year-old who's going to have a life extended a very short time would get the treatment and the 20-year-old would not. And that, a lot of people see that as unfair.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are accusations of age discrimination if you do.
Yeah.
Talk about rationing on the basis strictly of age, and that is usually considered out of bounds. But rationing on the basis of expected outcome is more acceptable.
All right, so folks, we have Stan Cox. We will be right back.